The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks, everyone, for being here this morning. Thanks for... I know all of you are up early anyway, because you're up early people, but thank you for taking a bit of time out of your morning schedule to be here. And for the City Bible Forum, it's always such a pleasure to partner with you guys. As you can see, I have a very strong Singaporean accent. I've been here for 2 weeks, and I've just picked up the Australian accent very quickly. No, I grew up here, so it's really nice to be home as well. And this is the end of actually this speaking trip that I've been on with the City Bible Forum, but... such an honour to be working with these guys. So thank you for coming. I hope this is helpful and useful for you. Wherever you are in your search for truth, your search for faith, or your search for success. And most of us, most of the time, are looking for some combination of those three things, I think, if we're being honest, in some way. And so I want to talk about what real success actually looks like. The world has told us lots of different things. We all have very different ideas about what success looks like. The great thought leaders, the great philosophers, the great political leaders, the world leaders, the religious leaders have all come up with different ideas of what success looks like. And so there's plenty to say about this, and this morning I'm not going to be by any means exhaustive or exclusive in what I say in 20 minutes on this topic. But I want to talk about three things that continue to come up. They come up in the organizational theory, in leadership theory, in management theory, in the social psychology, on what are important components of success. And those three things are strategy, culture, and character. Strategy, culture, and character. So I want to talk about each of the three, how they relate to our world, our lived experience, and what we might be able to say, what conclusions we might be able to draw, having looked at these three things in the context of what real success might actually look like. So the word strategy, starting with strategy, first coined around the 6th century in the way that we understand it now, post-Roman Empire, coined in and around Rome actually, so around the remnants of the Roman Empire. And for a long time, strategy was thought of and understood in a military context. It was always known militarily. But put simply, strategy is reaching desired ends with available resources. Looking at what your available resources are and the ends or the objectives you want to attain and getting from this place to that place. That's all strategy is. But it didn't really move out of military speak into management speak, leadership speak, organizational speak, personal speak, until the 1900s, until after Henry Ford had scaled up manufacturing, the Industrial Revolution had really settled, and after the Second World War, where we saw strategy make its way into the individual psychology, the social psychology, the management theory, textbooks as an important concept. And that's when we saw organizations like Boston Consulting and McKinsey Group and these guys all pop up, because strategy became an important thing for businesses. But everything I'm going to say this morning, both on strategy, culture, and character, they apply at the individual level, at the family level, to a law firm, to a barrister's chambers, to a bench of judges, to a multinational corporation, to a small business, to any group of people or any individual as components of success. So strategy was a big deal for a long time. 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, strategy was the buzzword, if you like. And that's a good thing, I think. We see any success that's come. I'm sure you look at your own lives and look at the successes that you have had. There had to be some good strategy involved at some point. Some way of stepping back, some moment in which you or someone stepped back and thought, what's the way that I can get to where I want to go with the available means and resources that I've got? The risk with strategy, when it's all we think about, though, if it's our exclusive focus, is that strategy can become very outcomes-focused and outcome-centric, and we lose track of how we actually reach those outcomes. It doesn't really matter how we get there. If we're careless, we're just about the outcomes, and we lose track of whether we're getting there in an efficient way, in a productive way, in an ethical way, in a fulfilling way, in a moral way, in a thoughtful way. Being thoughtful of others, all of these sorts of things can be lost as considerations if strategy is exclusively what we think about and it's all we think about. So strategy without values is toothless. And we see this in our world and in our lives. I worked for the first Kevin Rudd government. I worked a little bit on the Kevin 07 election. Please don't run out of the cafe. And I worked in that first government as a political and policy advisor in social policy. And what was clear from that election campaign is our strategy was almost perfect, almost flawless politically. But right from the start, it was very clear to many of us inside that government that the culture wasn't right, that the values weren't quite right. We weren't clear and correct in how we were going about doing what we were doing. Even during the campaign, glimpses of this started to come out. And that's why I believe that that government only lasted, you know, around 18 months. And then we started changing prime ministers in this country, like Apple releases iPhones every 10 minutes or so. And that doesn't seem to have stopped, even since I left. But what was clear is that while strategy is important, strategy without values is toothless. There is a problem unless people are actually doing things in a certain way, believing things in a certain way, acting in a certain way, treating each other in a certain way while you're carrying out your strategy. So strategy without values is toothless. And management speak and leadership theory began to understand this in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And more recently, strategy has been, something has been brought alongside strategy as equally important, if not more important, and that's culture. And this is the new buzzword in management and leadership theory, culture. You've got to have the right culture. And you look at different companies and businesses and organizations and they'll say, we have a creative culture, we have an innovation culture, we have an integrity culture, we have a belonging culture, we have a thinking differently culture. And I was told when I was a young graduate, when I was applying for jobs in the private sector, all you have to say is you feel a culture fit with the organization and they'll hire you. And I hate to say it, it was actually true. I never said that once and didn't get offered a job. There might have been other things at play, hopefully. Hopefully I was suitable for the jobs that I was offered. But this idea of culture fit is huge. You hear it in churches, you hear it in universities, you hear it everywhere. I was studying at the University of Oxford. In all of the coaching programs of potential Oxford students, they say, talk about the culture of the university. Say you have a teachable culture in your family. Say you have, you come from an innovation culture. You have a you want to do translational research is part of your culture. It's all about culture. Pete Drucker, who's one of the modern forefathers of management theory, he very famously said, in a showdown between strategy and culture, culture eats strategy for breakfast. It's one of my favourite lines. It's great. We all know it. All of you here who have been leaders, who have led teams, who have led families, who have, you know, organised your own lives, you know from experience and from instinct that culture does eat strategy for breakfast. So culture is important. So while strategy without values is toothless, culture can help with that because it's about shared beliefs and behaviours. That's all culture really is. It's shared beliefs and behaviours. That's culture at its simplest level. And that's an important thing. If you have the right culture, things can work well. The problem, of course, is while strategy alone is not enough, culture alone has its problems as well. If culture is all we're talking about as the marker of success or the pathway to success, it has to be authentic. It has to be authentically felt by the people who are living out the culture. Because shared beliefs and behaviours can be faked. They can be acted out, as we all know all too well. Otherwise, everyone in every organisation would be perfectly acting out and living out and embodying the values statement of the organisation or the belief statement or the statement of faith or the statement of culture that the company has. And we know that culture without authenticity is meaningless. While strategy without values is toothless, culture without authenticity is meaningless. There was an investment bank on the island of Manhattan in downtown New York. On the morning of the 9/11 attacks, between the first plane hitting the tower, Tower 1, and the second plane hitting Tower 2, that investment bank, while everyone else was scrambling and trying to help each other and rescue each other, that investment bank continued trading in its commodities room, started shorting oil stocks because they knew that in any terrorist attack, two things will happen. The price of oil will drop dramatically and trading will be frozen by the federal government very quickly. And in between the first and the second plane hitting, that company, that investment house, made many hundreds of millions of dollars shorting oil commodities. They have on their culture statement integrity. And they didn't break any laws doing what they were doing. But was that culture actually meaningful? Was it being lived out in that moment when they were making money while 3,300 people were plummeting to their deaths? So we see that strategy without values is toothless, but culture without authenticity, culture not entirely bought into holistically by people, is meaningless. So where does that leave us? What does that then bring us to? Well, this is where we've really entered in the last 10, 15, 20 years in the psychology, in the leadership theory, and this is where the self-help industry has really jumped on board and made many, many billions out of this. Because people realize that strategy is not enough for success, culture is not enough for success, they're both important, but they need to be underpinned by character. The character of the individuals in a family, in an organization, in a business, in a church, that's where the real soil, the fertile ground for good culture, on which good strategy can then be built, begins. We need people of good character. But ironically, that's where all leadership and organizational psychology theory takes its bat and ball and goes home. Because they have no solution for character. All they say is just recruit people of good character. And so when you look at the good MBAs globally, when you look at Harvard and Yale and Princeton and UNSW, and you look at what they say about character, all it is about how to find people and recruit people of good character. There's no one that is willing and able to actually undertake the project of growing people of good character and establishing people of good character because it's so difficult. Because we know that imperfection inside of people, those desires, that darkness that's inside every single one of us. I know that it's inside me. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the Nobel Prize winner in literature, famously said that the line that divides good and evil cuts through the heart of every man and woman. We know this to be true of ourselves and of those around us. We've all got good inside us, but we've also got a lot of darkness, a lot of struggle, a lot of capacity for things that are antithetical to the kind of character that we want. But this idea of character, instinctively and also consciously, we know is important. It's what Aristotle and Plato were onto so many years ago. They were onto this, that success is really about how we live our lives and the way we live our lives. But the challenge we have is that all the world can offer us, certainly the self-help industry, which to their credit is one sector that does have a shot at improving our characters. It makes a cool $11 billion US a year trying to do it. But at least it tries. When psychology has left the building, when psychiatry has left the building, when materialism has left the building and all of the other isms have left the building. It's kind of all we've got left is this self-help industry. And what do they all tell us? They say look inside yourself and improve yourself from within. Personal development. And when we look at all of the religious worldviews too, that's broadly what it's about. It's about pulling ourselves up by our moral and existential bootstraps. So this is the solution for character, on which we can then build culture, on which then we can then build strategy. Problem is, it hasn't seemed to have worked. We are equipped now with more resources than we've ever been before as a human race to undertake this project of character development, and yet all the markers of human character aren't really moving anywhere. We have all the things that we've always had to struggle with growing in real and relative terms at pretty alarming rates. Things like suicide and homicide and anxiety and depression and social dysfunction and social dislocation, all of these things are all still there. So what is the solution with all of these theories telling us to dig deep within ourselves and build up our own character within our own strength? Well, we come now to this unique solution that is offered through the person of Jesus Christ. Jesus says, quite simply, don't at first instance worry about strategy. Don't worry about culture. Don't even worry about character. I know those things are tough in your own strength. Just come to me first. Believe in me. In that short extract that's in your handout, he says, to paraphrase him, believe in God, believe in me. And then Thomas asks him, how do we know? Where's the leadership textbook? Where's the way to success? Which book from the personal development shelf do we need to go and buy? How do we know? What is the way to get this done? What's the theory? How do we build our own character? And Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. That's key. He's not pointing to another way. He points to himself and says, I am the way. Every other theory, every other worldview, religious and irreligious, theistic and atheistic, points to another way or some set of truths. Whereas Jesus just points to himself and says, I am the way. I'm the truth, I'm the life. There's a guy called Paul, who's one of the first evangelists, one of the first great Christian scholars and philosophers and thinkers and evangelists. And he writes in one of his letters to one of the early churches in Rome, he says, when you're walking, he says, when we're called to walk with God, when you say yes to Jesus and say yes to living a life with him, you get to enjoy an experience and you're called to the renewing of your mind. He said, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Very significant that he doesn't say, come and be transformed by the improving of yourself. He says, be transformed by the renewing of your mind. And this is where the message of Jesus is so powerful and so unique, because you won't see this anywhere in management or organizational or leadership or psychological or psychiatric theory. Because that's all about the improving of the self. It's about things that we think and say and feel and do and working at changing those things. All pathways to success outside of the Christian vision are grounded in some way in what we think and say and feel and do. It's all stuff that is up to us. It's on us. Whereas when we come to the person of Jesus, our success is grounded ontologically. It's not grounded in what we think or feel or say or do. It's grounded in who we are. It's the only worldview that does that. It's the only worldview that does that. It anchors us in who we are. It gives us success based on who we are. And powerfully, it's not based on who we are in our own strength, because it's a transformative gift that we are given when we say yes to the person of Jesus. So on top, once that starts happening, then we get to experience this renewing of our mind. Is it perfect? Is it instant? Of course not. Lots of Christian rat bags running around. You just look around the cafe. Look at the guy with the microphone in his hand. But what it does mean is that we are offered it as a free gift. And we are then empowered with two incredible things that no other worldview offers. One is, in relation to our character, we have an objective moral reference point against which to determine what's good and what's bad, and to live our lives, a compass that's independent of ourselves. My boss Ravi says, if there's no God, if we reject that objective moral reference point, then you say some people out there love their neighbours, some people out there eat their neighbours, how do we know which one's right? We need an objective reference point, otherwise it's just your opinion against my opinion. So when we accept God, when we accept Jesus and who he is and what he's saying, we have that objective reference point. Secondly, and equally importantly, we are empowered with the horsepower and the resources to live that out. Even if it's not perfect, we have that experience of walking with God through the challenges of life. And when we have those things, we're secure, we're fulfilled, we have all the identity and validation we'll ever need, and then we can go about building the cultures and the strategies that we want, already having success locked up and banked because we're walking with God. Thanks so much for listening. Hope that's been helpful. All right, thank you all so much for your questions. There's some great questions here. Yeah, feel free to keep them coming. I'll try and get through them as quickly as I can. There's a couple of questions here that kind of touch on a similar theme, so I'll read them together and try and answer them together. If coming to Jesus does as you say, why are there still some Christian ratbags? And then, I assume you're quoting me there. And then, does Christian faith, does believing in Jesus in the way you say so, really make any difference to character in your experience? And then I've got a couple of case study examples that someone would probably like discussed. I've basically Kevin Rudd versus Julia Gillard, Tony Abbott versus Malcolm Turnbull, and some question marks and some labels next to those four names. So I'll deal with all of that together. It's a great question. And the short answer is, and one of my friends and colleagues, Sam Albury, says this. I wish I'd come up with this quote, but it's his quote, so I have to mention him. He said, the first point we have to remember, whether we're Christians or not, is that it makes no sense to judge Jesus by Christians. We should be judging Christians by Jesus. He's the reference point. He's the marker, right? So if you're investigating Christianity, yes, of course, you should get alongside Christians and investigate with them and ask them for help and reach out to them. But be very careful to judge the truth value of Christianity by us. Because if Christianity is true, and I believe it to be so, then what you would expect is for me as a Christian to still be completely messed up in many, many different ways. And I think that's what you see. I think it was, who was it? Was it Billy Graham who said, if you find a perfect church, don't go there, you'll ruin it. Right? So Christianity is not about making bad people good. That's the biggest misunderstanding out there. My boss Ravi says, it's not about making bad people good, it's about making dead people live. So the transformation we're talking about is a much deeper spiritual, transcendental transformation that is happening. A life lived with Jesus takes away our guilt, takes away our shame, takes away the uncertainty that we have, in relation to who we are and where we're going and where we're headed. It doesn't take away our humanity. It does not take away our humanity. After we come into a relationship with God through the person of Jesus, then it's really a matter for how obedient we want to be to Him and to the way that God wants us to live, as to how much we want to buy in to that character transformation that I was talking about. And that's one of the reasons, the two reasons why you see Christians of all different levels of ratbaggery, if you like, is because we all have different starting points. That's the first thing. And secondly, we've all bought in to the transformative process in different ways and different levels based on our own characters, our own journeys, our own experiences, and what we're going through at the moment. So all people are completely different. C.S. Lewis very famously said, don't judge the Christian faith by any given Christian in the abstract. Look at what their life was like before they became a Christian, and then look at what their life was like after. And he said, the truth of Christianity rests in the fact that even the scoundrel is less of a scoundrel after he comes to know Jesus, though he still may have some scoundrelous aspects in his life and in his heart. So it is progressive in that sense. And when I refer to what Paul was writing, he said, the transformation is being is having your mind renewed. It's not being suddenly gifted with a different mind. It's having it renewed. So there is a progression as part of that. So I think that's what I would recommend. In my experience, absolutely it's made a difference. It's made a difference in my own life. That's what I can speak to without any question. My walk with God has changed my character in many, many different ways. In how I see other people, in how I see and treat women, in how I think about suffering, in how I... my capacity to empathize and sympathize, the way I value money and elements of pride and greed that I used to have in my life, which I still have aspects of, but far, far less since I've been walking with God. So I see aspects of that renewal very slowly, but very surely happening in my life. So I can certainly testify to that. How does suffering preserve, help, and build character? That's a really good question. I think suffering, it stretches us, it strengthens us, and it builds our character, but it only does so if we have something to get us through the suffering and a hope beyond the suffering. Just surviving suffering for survival's sake, I think is a very difficult thing to do, and people can get beaten down by it. The human spirit of resilience is remarkable, and so people can withstand and endure enormous amounts of suffering. The uniqueness of the Christian message is it doesn't pretend to give you ways of getting around suffering or avoiding suffering. It actually says, hey, this is a God that understands that life is imperfect, that the world is imperfect, that there is going to be suffering that we go through. But this is a God that actually stepped into that suffering, literally himself, as a person that suffered for us, and that now, if we say yes to him, is willing to suffer alongside us and go with us through the suffering. So this is a God who endures suffering with us. He conquers through the suffering, doesn't pretend to give us theories or philosophies of avoiding it or getting around it. And so when we do that with him, I think we are strengthened, because it's kind of like being refined through a fire. One of Jesus's disciples, Peter, wrote a letter and he talks about being refined through fire. When you're refining the ore that gold is encased in order to get the gold, you do have to burn it off. And when you burn that ore, all of the muck, all of the non-gold kind of rises, and you can just kind of scrape it off. And what you're left with at the end is gold. So I think suffering can be like that, in a sense. It can help us help others dealing with that kind of suffering, and it can strengthen us in ourselves, in our own character, our own purpose, our own resilience as well, going through that. But I think doing that with a God who loves us, who understands, who has the credibility to go through suffering with us, I think is kind of key. You know, out of all the gods that humankind has manufactured for itself, and you look at all of them and you look at Jesus, Jesus is the only God with scars. He's the only God that has scars. That says something to me. That's quite powerful. That's a God who has suffered, does suffer, understands suffering better than anyone else. Many people would say that a person's ethics are set in their home life. Is it possible for someone to change their character? And then a statement which I agree with, the ethics courses offered in the business world seem to have little effect. I think absolutely right. I think ethics are primarily set in the home life. I think that's why what parents do in raising their kids is so important. And I think they're both set in the home life. They're also demonstrated in the home life. So to see someone's ethical framework or see their level of integrity or their character, I think you've got to watch them at home. You've got to watch them where no one else can see. So I think that is quite key. And I think you can change your character, and I think you can change your character with or without God. I'm not, you know, hyper ideological about this. I don't think Christianity has a monopoly on, you know, ethical behavior or moral behavior. This whole "can you be good without God" question. Of course you can. There's lots of people out there doing good work and doing good things and living moral and ethical lives. The more important point, I think, is you can't have a meaningful understanding of the concept of good without God. That's the key. You need some objective reference point to even be able to make the statement that something is good and something is evil, that there's actually an ethical right and a wrong way to live. So that's the first thing we need God for. And the second thing I think we need him for is to actually empower us and give us help in actually living that way. Yeah, because of what Solzhenitsyn said, we struggle in our own strength to be good. And we might say, look, we're not murderers, we haven't, you know, killed anyone or hit anyone or whatever it is, but we know deep down that all of those urges and those instincts and those even thoughts are inside of us. And that's why, you know, Paul writes in that same letter I was talking about really powerfully, he says, that's why we all fall short of the glory of God. Like, God's ultimate moral perfection and our ultimate moral imperfection is kind of unarguable. And that's really what Christians are talking about when we use words like sin. That's all it is. It's just falling short of who God is and what his level of moral perfection is. So I think you can... The home is an incredibly important place for setting ethical frameworks and setting moral frameworks, and that can and should be done. But to be done meaningfully and enduringly, I think it needs to be done with God, who gives us the objective reference point and who gives us the empowering, transformative experience that we need in order to actually live that out authentically. This kind of flows from that, which is really, how can the likes of, you know, the Harvards and the Princetons and so forth incorporate Christian thinking into their MBAs in such a politically correct world without offending other worldviews? I think it can be done so, and I should say that I'm not arguing for a second for any kind of theocracy, even a theocracy in a university. What I'm saying is that for morality to work and for morality to actually have substantive meaning and impact in the real world, people need to agree on an objective point of reference. That's the first thing to do. Whereas in so many universities today, certainly the ones I studied at, and I studied at some pretty good ones, this idea of moral relativism is huge. Just find your own moral truth. So we're pumping out these graduates, telling them to go and find their own truth and build their own ethical frameworks. And then we're all very confused when they wind up on the front pages having embezzled this or laundered this. And they're just behaving exactly how we taught them to behave, you know, in these degrees that we charge them hundreds of thousands of dollars for. Then we pay them millions of dollars and they're just doing what they've been told to do. So for starters, I think we have to get honest with ourselves and have a culture of truth in academia. And a culture of truth necessarily leads you to a point where you have to be honest with people about what moral relativism actually means. We know that can't work in the legal world. We know when we look at the development of the Roman British legal tradition, it came from a place of absolute moral truth. We look at bodies of law like equity. When equity actually grew, it's now been reincorporated into the common law. But we know when the law of equity grew, it grew because obeying the letter of common law was yielding way, way back, hundreds of years back, it was yielding outcomes that we knew were unethical or seemed unfair on some level. And so things like injunctions and principles like estoppel and so many of these principles, they all grew because of an understanding that there is an objective point of moral reference, and this legal system that we are inventing has to serve that objective point of moral reference. So we see it not just in the legal sector, you see it everywhere. And I think business schools need to be at the forefront of accepting and understanding that need for an objective point of reference. What the source is, we can argue about later. You know, these business schools are not schools of divinity, they're not seminaries. So there is a common pool of moral thinking that we should all be buying into. And I think the Muslim and the Hindu and the atheist and the humanist should all be contributing to that. But I think we need to start by actually acknowledging that we are trying to run a society here. And in order to do that sensibly and reasonably, we need to have an objective point of moral reference. Someone like John Rawls, who wrote Political Liberalism, he talks about public reason liberalism, that we all need to contribute with whatever beliefs we bring to that common pool of moral thinking. I don't think that's a bad strategy. There's some problems with it, but if we let all people of all beliefs and all faiths contribute to that, then I think that's a good thing. But just abandoning the field, throwing the baby out with the bathwater and saying there's no such thing as moral truth, we should just invent our own moral truths, I think that's number one, a cop-out, and number two, that leads to very dangerous outcomes where you're going to see a lot of immoral and unethical behaviour. So thank you for that question. Last question, how does recognising Jesus' claims that I am the way, the truth and the life affect one's character, and what meaning can we derive from this? This is a fantastic question. If I had a little more time in the talk, I would have gone into this in a little more depth. And I'm sorry I'm going to do this question injustice in a really short time just to finish up. But acknowledging that Jesus is what we need on any number of levels, it helps to define our moral character in two ways, in my view. One is it acknowledges that we don't belong exclusively to ourselves. We're not in charge and in command of our own lives in the way that sometimes instinctively we would love to be. We'd love to be in charge of our own lives. But if we acknowledge that we were made by a creator who knows us, who loves us, then we have to also acknowledge that he knows what's best for us. In the same way that if you have an iPhone, you don't take it to the dishwasher repairman when something goes wrong. You don't take it to Samsung when something goes wrong. You take it to AppleCare when something goes wrong. If you can afford AppleCare, you take it to AppleCare. If you're very wealthy, you take it to AppleCare. Why do we do that? We do that because we know the creator of the phone knows how the phone operates best, how to optimize its functioning. In the same way, because we are created, it's our creator who knows how we operate best. And so in order for us to function best, to flourish, both in terms of our character, our culture, our strategies, anything we do in life, it makes sense for us to draw our framework for living from that creator. So the Christian message is not just the greatest rescue mission. It doesn't just give us that sense of fulfillment and hope and rescue and eternal life and all of those things that we're looking for. It's also the greatest blueprint for human flourishing, because it's a blueprint that was set down by the creator himself. And so if we submit ourselves to that, and it does take submission, and submission's a very, very ugly, nasty, disgusting word in 2018. We do have to be willing to put something else before us. No one likes that. But if we're willing to do that, and we do that in the right way to the right person, then everything will flourish, everything will flow well, and everything will change for the better, including our character. I hope that's helpful. That might be a nice way to finish. Thanks, Peter.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.